Okay, first matter of this morning, docket number 84110, Helm versus New Voters First PAC. Council, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Do you want to reserve any time?
Yes, sir. I want to reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes you got.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, may it please the court, good morning. I'm Mr. Schrager. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Helton. Your Honors, the initiative right is an important and enumerated right in the Nevada Constitution. There's no question about that. However, for the privilege of exercising it, there are certain regulations and laws and statutes that the Nevada legislature has enacted to facilitate the process. And one must take on the responsibility of meeting those in order to, once again, act in the legislative capacity of the people. This particular petition has a number of flaws that fail to meet those requirements and their responsibility. Let's begin, if we can, with single subject. The single subject rule found in 295.009 functions to focus petition signers' attention on the individual subject being advanced. In this initiative, there are two discrete and major reforms that would represent a pair of radical disjunctures with the historical conduct of Nevada elections. Now, it's very easy to give them sort of shorthand names, open primary and ranked choice voting. And that, they seem rather petite. They could, I understand it would be council's job to stand up and say, they're not that major. They could live in a shoebox. But they are, in fact, tremendously effective of the historical conduct of Nevada's elections. Open primaries will affect how not just major parties, but minor parties, every political actor will engage with the electoral process. Ranked choice voting would overturn 160 years with the plurality voting in what I will sort of refer to as a newfangled way of casting and tabulating ballots. Now, it goes without saying that there's no necessary connection between these two underpins. There are some states that have ranked choice voting. There are some states that have open primaries. You may have one without the other. And although one of the policies underlying single subject is to guard against multiple major shifts in law through the initiative process. However, there's nothing expressly in Nevada law that says you can't have more than one major shift in an initiative. Understood. For purposes of the single subject rule, what matters is the relationship between these two discrete reforms and also their mutual relationship to the primary purpose or the primary subject. And in fact, this court has used those terms both to mean the same thing interchangeably and in different contexts as a sort of most important way of describing what they have to meet. Because in 295.009, the parts of the initiative must be functionally related and germane to each other, and as further defines that as in a way that provides sufficient notice of the general subject of and the interests likely to be affected by the measure. That second part is something I will return to again throughout my argument. So what is the primary subject or the primary purpose here? Below, in both briefing and argument to the district court, what was advanced was to enfranchise nonpartisan voters to participate in primaries and expand choices in the general election. Now, I would suggest to you, to enfranchise nonpartisan voters to participate in primaries, I mean, I agree with that, but that's a perfectly acceptable version of a primary subject or purpose for the first, the open primaries portion of this initiative petition. The second, again, I may not agree with it, but how expanding choices in the general election is one way to describe what ranked choice voting does. It is in the combination, the fact that respondents couldn't stick with just those two because they sort of evince a single subject violation. What they needed to do was raise a level or two of abstraction that could somehow encompass the entirety of the initiative in one primary purpose. And what they've settled on, what the district court agreed with them on, is that the primary purpose or subject here is how specified office holders are chosen by voters. That is what we think, Your Honors, is excessively general, not just by this court's jurisprudence, but obviously on its face. How office holders are chosen by the voters, in fact, describes the entirety of Title 24 of the Nevada Revised Statutes. all nine of its chapters, the hundreds of its sections, the thousands of its subsections could be stuffed under that particular rubric. That is how we choose office holders by the voters. In fact, how specified office vote holders are chosen by voters is only made slightly smaller than simply elections or democracy by the inclusion of the word specified. What I suggest to you is that that does not take it down enough from its generalized abstract level to capture what's necessary under the single subject rule. And if you look at this court's jurisprudence, especially in the most recent cases, this is only a 15, 18-year-old statute. Right? We had the common law single subject before that. But since the jurisprudence on 295.09 has developed, choosing office holders is much closer, for example, to the single subject in Las Vegas taxpayers, which was voter approval of large finance projects, than it is to, for example, in the education initiative, funding public education, or the Prevent Sanctuary Cities initiative, which may have had multiple layers, but was trying to achieve one thing at those various layers. That's what this court ruled. But in Las Vegas taxpayers, what the key language from that is, only an exceptionally broad subject, such as voter approval, or here, choosing officers, could encompass both of the initiative's provisions, and that a subject so defined does not meet 295.09's requirements. In Las Vegas taxpayers, you also identified and agreed with California courts who had looked at excessively general, or at least insufficiently narrow, subjects and said, that's more than one, right? That's too broad. Government, fiscal affairs, public welfare, public disclosure, all of those are simply too broad. Essentially, the way of repeating in two words, or in one word, how specified office holders are chosen by voters is elections. Because what you could do with that, if you were to approve that as a primary subject or primary purpose, there was essentially no end to the potential omnibus election bills or petitions that could come before you as initiatives. You could upend early voting. You could eliminate it. You could change the recall or the recount codes. You could change election contests. You could change the entire parameters of voter registration. You could do all of those things. And you could plausibly say that's part of how we choose our public officers. For those reasons, it is simply overbroad. Now, as I said, the magnitude of the changes is not necessarily determinative, but the bigger the changes get, the harder it is to stuff them into one primary subject. And number two, the harder it is to describe them properly within the 200 words. Primary elections in Nevada, are not just subparts or steps in a single election process. They are not semifinals in an election tournament. They are, general elections are where we choose our public officers. Primaries are separate pre-election processes through which the members of major parties choose their standard bearers and select their nominees. That is a party process. Anyone who has gotten a nonpartisan ballot during a primary knows it is exceedingly thin. But the major purpose of a primary is to permit members of a major political party to select their standard bearers. Furthermore, for minor parties and independents, it's not a step in the election process at all. They have other avenues to get to the ballot. In fact, they're barred from engaging in primaries. Now, as far as the ranked choice goes, you can think it's a good idea. You can think it's a weird idea. It doesn't matter. It is certainly a tremendous change in our electoral structure. Article 15, Section 14, or since the founding of this state, has said that a plurality in an election will constitute a choice. That's how you win an election. We'll return to that in a moment. But this is, in essence, a classic example of log rolling. Now, oftentimes when you see log rolling, what you have is one popular, or presumably popular, provision alongside an unpopular provision. And the voters have to take it or leave it. But it's also possible to have log rolling when the two are unrelated, or you can't tell which is popular or not popular. You can't tell what the signatories would vote for. You can certainly say in this instance, you can imagine Nevada voters who would say, I think it's time for open primaries. That's a terrific idea. But I don't understand this ranked choice vote. You could absolutely imagine the opposite of that. This is the hallmark. These two lack a central unifying purpose, and any potential unifying purpose is far too generalized. This would force voters to accept or reject an omnibus collection of unrelated changes to law in a take it or leave it fashion, which is exactly what the single subject rule is meant to prevent. Now, furthermore,
Mr. Schrager, yes, you addressed the recent Alaska case dealing with a similar proposal and finding it to be a single subject.
Yeah. The Alaska case, upon which respondents rely as well, is in a very different context. Every state that has a single subject rule has derived it or has interpreted it differently. Alaska, for example, meshes their legislative single subject rule and their initiative single subject rule in a much more liberal fashion than this court. This court has chosen over the years to realize that the difference between initiated legislation and regular legislation is the possibility of amendments, committees, the entire legislative process in which there will be deliberation over time. Because of that, although the language of both our legislative single subject rule and our initiative single subject rule are remarkably similar, they have been interpreted by this court in different ways. So the Alaska court was operating from a very different interpretive context in which the liberalization of their rule does not match ours. So that's the fundamental difference between that Alaska case and this. But I will return to the Alaska case for a moment as I shift to the description of a fact clause. In that,
but before you do that, though, it strikes me that the statute is enacted pursuant to subsection 5 of Article 19. And the question I have, I mean, anybody, it depends on whether you're at 50,000 feet or the issues right in front of you, whether you see it as multiple sub-issues or one general subject. And so in interpreting what is a single subject for purposes of that statute, it seems to me that we need to interpret the statute in a way that is congruent with facilitating the initiative power in Nevada Constitution reserves to the voters. So it's always struck me as anomalous to say, for voters passing an initiative, the single subject rule is going to parse it much closer and much more finely than the legislative one is. And I get that we follow precedent, and I'm not advocating its overthrow. But it strikes me that the perspective we adopt has to be driven by the constitutional scheme and the proper interpretation of statutes enacted under that.
I would disagree with that. I think any difference we have on that is a point of emphasis, which is the initiative process is not just something that belongs to the proponents. It is something that you'll be putting out into the world among voters. Okay. And that the legislature, in its wisdom, has decided that, yes, this is different than regular legislation. The reason why we have a descriptional effect, the reason why all the states have title controversies or have descriptional effect controversies, is that it is important, though though there should be a right to do this, and it should be liberally construed, the facilitation of that right does include an understanding of how voters are going to interact with that the one time they see it. Maybe two of you are signatory, but those that is one time on the ballot. But I think that that's the balance. And so pitching the single subject properly is incredibly important. I'm winding down. I'm going to press on if that's all right, and I will abandon if necessary, or leave myself to the court's indulgence regarding rebuttal time, because there's some important things I want to very quickly say about the description of effect, which, as this court knows, is incredibly important. It cannot be minimized. You have to be accurate and not misleading. You have to be non-argumentative. It's also a statement of effects, not just a description. The word that keeps coming up in this court's jurisprudence is ramifications. And talk about what it's going to do, not just what it is. Well, this particular initiative, for example, let's not even talk about its effect on major parties. That's in the briefing as well. Think about its effect on minor parties and independents, who at the moment don't have to go to primaries at all. We're in the midst of primaries at the moment. All of our mailboxes, all of our television commercial time is cluttered with political advertising. This particular initiative would force minor party candidates, Green Party, IEP, whoever it is, independent candidates, to compete in money and time and attention with well-funded Democratic or Republican candidates. That's something I think people should know, because it would require redoing the entirety of the law on minor parties, whose life as minor parties exists due to how many votes they get. I don't even know how you can describe that here. Can I ask the court for...
I'll let you finish up your statement, and I'm going to offer you 2 minutes of time, and I'll add 2 minutes to your opposing colleague's time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, the briefing also talks about the flaws in the description effect regarding disclosures of voter information that they demand be made on the ballot, but can't be bothered to put in the description effect regarding the self-identification of candidates, and that somehow traditionally we have always had majority victories in elections. That's clearly not true. That's just obviously factually not true. You can win an election with a plurality here in Nevada. And with that, I thank the court's indulgence.
Good morning. May it please the court. Todd Weiss on behalf of the respondents. So let me begin with the premise. I wrote the word down that my colleague, Mr. Schrager, mentioned, which was the purpose of the statute is to facilitate the initiative process. And that's the problem here. The opponent is trying to use this statute to obstruct the process. And that is always what happens with these attempts to use the single subject rule to break it down, that every initiative can be challenged under the single subject rule. If you just keep parsing it down long enough, you can say that every subpart is its own separate subject. And let me address that briefly, because council really doesn't disagree that all the initiatives provisions functionally relate to and are germane to the subject. What he says is, well, the subject is too broad. So I would ask the court, I can dispense with that, I think, quite simply. Ask the court this question. Assume that the initiative is simply only applied to one office, the office of governor. Let's just use that as an example. This initiative applied only to the office of governor. Is how you choose your governor a single subject? Or is that a subject matter of excessive generality? As counsel would have to argue, does the open primaries relating to the office of governor, is that functionally relate to then the general election where you have ranked choice voting? Would all function together hand in glove in how you pick your governor? That's what this initiative does. It just does it for more than one office.
So, Mr. Bice, what is the single subject of the BBN initiative?
I'm sorry?
What is the single subject?
The single subject is how you choose these elected representatives. I just give you the example with the governor. Is how you choose your governor, is that a single subject? Or is it excessively general, as they would have to argue? Because they have to argue even that one is excessively general in order to sustain their arguments that somehow ranked choice voting and open primaries don't functionally relate to each other in how these offices are elected. And they're wrong on that. They clearly relate to each other because they are intertwined with each other. This was the point of the Alaska Supreme Court decision. The Alaska court addressed this. That initiative was even broader because it also included some campaign finance issues. But I'm focusing only on this aspect of it. We are proposing for the voters, for their consideration, whether or not we should open the primaries up so that everybody has to compete. The top five finishers then go into the general, and they can employ, if they want, ranked choice voting.
So
that functionally relates to each other, because then you do not end up with the take it or leave it choice in the general.
So, Mr. Yes. Price, isn't there a risk that people who are being asked potentially if they want to sign this petition, or mm-hmm. who were asked,
sure.
That they will say, you know, oh, open primaries. Okay, I like that idea. There are so many nonpartisan registered voters now. Let's let them in the primary system, but have no idea what ranked choice voting is or how it works. Isn't there a risk that people are signing on, not really understanding what that second piece of this is?
That's a risk with every initiative. I mean, if that were the standard that the court reviewed an initiative by, you could always say that the voters
don't. Is it like a form of log rolling, I guess?
No, the answer to that is no, because log rolling is when you have two discrete unrelated subject matters and you are trying to roll one into the other. You have this popular one over here that will attract the voters, and you have this unpopular one over here that they wouldn't otherwise vote for. And you merge them together because they're unrelated. But every initiative has different components to it, unless you're going to just have the simplest of components. And again, just in case, I'll use my example. If I had an initiative that was limited only to the governor, and it told the voters, this is how we're proposing to choose the governor of the state, open primary, ranked choice voting. Is that a single subject? I would have to submit it. Absolutely has to be. And if it's not, then I would submit to this court that is frustration of the initiative process. That's not facilitation. That's trying to deprive the voters of their rights to enact legislation.
One of the things Mr. Schrager commented on was that these two things can exist without the other.
Absolutely.
You can have open primaries or you can have ranked choice voting.
Yep.
How do you have ranked choice voting work if you have closed primaries with only Republicans and Democrats, for instance, at five?
That's why they are interrelated, and that's why the one enhances the other. I acknowledge some states have done it differently. They absolutely do. Some have ranked choice voting separately, and some have open primaries separately and don't do both. This is the point that the Alaska Supreme Court made this point. But they functionally relate together because if you only have, for example, ranked choice voting and not the open primaries, what are you ranking? You typically have A or B as your choice.
Well, that was my point. If there's not a minority party candidate at the primary time and it's just people filing in the two major offices and right. Nonpartisan voters therefore aren't voting because it's a closed primary, is there a ranked choice in the general election, even if you have ranked choice voting?
I'm not following the hypothetical exactly.
So if all you have is Republicans and Democrats, for instance, that file for the office and no independent party candidates,
right,
then all you're going to end up with is one Republican and one Democrat on the general election ballot.
Sure, that can happen. If you have less than five.
Right.
Right? If you have less than five, you're going to, you know, you could end up down at two, as an example, and then it's just A or B. You're back to the take it or leave it choice.
Which is my point is that's not giving the voters ranked choice, is it? It's just A and B.
Yeah, sure, but I can envision all sorts of hypotheticals where in a discrete instance where there's not sufficient competition for the seat,
right,
that the ranking may not actually occur. But that doesn't mean that they're not interrelated with each other and that they're not, that they don't interact with each other in the broader elections.
No, understood.
I mean, there's plenty of competition usually for congressional seats. I mean, and just in case back to your point of you're saying, well, gee, might some voters favor ranked choice voting, but favor open primaries and might not favor ranked choice voting. Of course that's a possibility. Just like it's a possibility that some voters might say, well, I favor this system for my congressional candidates, but not for my state constitutional executive offices. Or I favor this system for my state legislators because they're elected by district as opposed to the state state constitutional executive offices. That doesn't turn every election, every office into a separate subject. And by the way, that's why I pointed out in the brief, that really is. I understand Mr. Schrager says that's not their argument, but when you strip it down, it really is their argument. Because every office under their approach would have to be deemed a separate subject. Because voters might want it for their governor, might not want it for their state legislator, might want it for their congressional member, might not want it for their state officials. That doesn't mean it's a separate subject. The question before the court is, do these provisions work together to achieve the initiative's purpose? That's the only standard. And the court's role here isn't to decide that
I don't think that's what our law says. I think we work the other direction. We don't define the subject by starting with what the components are. We define the subject and determine whether the components are competing. In this case, mm-hmm. I understand your hypothetical with respect to the governor, but your proposed petition includes other offices.
Correct.
So my question is, how would you define this subject of this petition that encompasses those offices? I played around myself drafting some choices as to how one might characterize the subject. I think you would agree with me that a subject that is simply election reform is vastly too broad.
Yes.
And is nowhere near what we did in eminent domain, for example, as a category in NPPRI, although that was pretty broad.
Well, I would submit to you that your sanctuary cities ruling, I understand unpublished, and that your eminent domain ruling were subject matters of significant breadth.
I agree.
And what the court said was that the provisions all related to those subject matters.
That's why, and all the provisions, that's why I concurred in NPPRI. But all I can say is how would you characterize the subject in this proposed initiative?
As I have indicated before, and as the district court said, the subject matter of this is how these, and you can break it down even like this, how the voters select their elected representatives for Congress, executive branch, constitutional offices, and state legislatures.
Okay.
That is the subject matter. Right. That's how those offices are chosen. How are these people elected?
Right.
And by the way, whether it's ranked choice voting or it's open primaries, both of those relate to that subject matter. Mm-hmm. And that's why, again, Justice Hardesty, I said, you could break it down even further if you want. You could eliminate Congress, you could eliminate executive branch officers and eliminate state legislators and just say governor. You can keep dwelling this, breaking it down as far as you want, so as to say everything else is too broad of a subject matter, and you would have to deal with these office by office. My point is this, once you admit, which, with all due respect, you have to admit that the office of governor, how you choose your governor, would be a single subject under the state constitution. And if not, then I submit that the court's jurisprudence is actually interfering with the voters' rights. Mm-hmm. So once you acknowledge that the office of governor, how you choose your governor, is a single subject, do these provisions all relate to that? Absolutely they relate to it. And they work together to effectuate how the governor is chosen. The fact that I apply it to multiple offices doesn't change a single subject analysis at all.
But Mr. Bice, I just, that the umbrella that we're opening here feels very large. And so my question is, when do you cut it off? So you say, how we choose our representatives. So these things relate to how we choose our representatives. Although I question how they relate to each other. Okay, so could you add in? So could you add one more in? Add elimination of early voting. And they all relate to how we choose our people, or when or where. So you could add under what you're proposing here, they'd all be one subject, because how we choose is this large umbrella. And even though those are discrete, or can be considered discrete, I guess that's what we're arguing here today, in separate issues, then how big is the umbrella here?
Justice English, I have to disagree with you that the umbrella is so large that it would encompass things like recall processes or early voting and the like. This is how the votes, who is eligible to vote and how their votes are counted. That's what this is about.
Who is eligible and how they're counted.
Of course. Who's eligible for office and how are they elected? That's with all due respect, that is a single subject. I mean, the whole point of this is who's eligible to run for governor and who's eligible to vote for that person. Those relate to, and they are intertwined with, how that person is selected by the voters. And that is a single subject under the statute. And if it's not a single subject under the statute, then this statute is being abused in violation of the rights of the citizenry. Because what it's being used to compromise their ability to make effective use of their power of initiative. Because at the end of the day, I would submit, you have to admit what you would really be saying if this is a single subject violation. They'd have to do a separate initiative for each office then. And that just simply is inconsistent with the rights of the voters.
Mr. Bice, I would like you to get to the description of effect topic, because I have some questions with regard to that.
Let me turn to that. So the description of effect I find particularly interesting here, because It's obviously it's no secret. I draft the description of effect, and there's a lot of people that wanted me to use it as an advocacy piece for why the initiative was so great and why the voters should vote for it. And I didn't do that. I followed the statute. I created a description of effect that is a neutral and non-argumentative statement of what this initiative proposes to change. And that's what the whole purpose of the description is. Mr. Helton, I think, exposed himself when the district court ordered him to prepare a description. And what he came back with was an absolute advocacy piece of partisan spin in politics, misrepresenting the offices to which it applied, misrepresenting what it did, etc.
Well, I have something that I hope you won't view as partisan, and neither will Mr. Schrager.
All right.
In Nevada, we have this odd statute that, at least for state office holders and certainly for Supreme Court justices, says that people can vote, I don't want that person.
Yes.
In the description of effect, I don't see that anomaly addressed.
That anomaly.
And particularly in the context of the calculation of 50%, because at least in Supreme Court races, as an example, you do not find anybody, even Cherry, doing much better than about 28% of nonpartisan of people who say we don't want that person.
Yes, but with ranked choice voting, Justice Hardesty, that can't happen, and I will explain why. Because as the votes keep tabulating,
so I'm going back to being the accountant. How do I calculate 50%? Do I include or exclude people who said I don't want any of these people?
Well,
can you tell me that?
I don't know. I can't tell you that.
What's the denominator? What's the numerator? That's all I want to know. Very simple.
What I would tell the court this is that there are a lot of what you could call anomalies that are not addressed by the description of effect. Because it's impossible to summarize every aspect of an initiative in the description. Well, what I'm telling the voters
is... But the point is that without knowing that calculus, the issue about 50% becomes illusory.
Without knowing that calculus,
if 33% of the voters pick none of these candidates,
right,
then what is it 50% of? Is it 50% of all the votes cast, or just 50% of those that picked a candidate?
The discussion is about the statement in there as traditionally someone with over 50% is the winner. Well, someone with over 50% is traditionally the winner. By definition, they are the winner. There can't be someone who gets 50% plus one who is not the winner. The discussion that you two are raising, as I understand it, is there a circumstance that could arise where somebody doesn't get over 50% and still wins? Okay? And as I understand that question, the answer to that is no, because under ranked choice voting, the next in line vote keeps getting moved up to number one. And so then by the time the winner is necessarily the person who has received more than 50%.
Is none of these candidates one of those choices?
I'm sorry?
Is none of these candidates one of those choices that gets dropped? Because I'm not sure that can be allowed.
Well, that person, so are you saying is that can none of these candidates receive more than 50% of the votes? So I believe
or,
the answer.
Or even if it doesn't. Is it included in the ranked choice process?
That I can't answer you right off the top of my head because I don't believe we've analyzed that. But the point being is that the legislature, as we have said, will be adopting enabling legislation. The point here is under this constitutional provision, what will happen is the candidates, the top five, will move up into the general. That's what will happen, the top five. And if those top five, out of those top five, the person who receives more than 50% of the first place votes, and those first place votes may adjust as the tabulations have to occur, will win. By necessity, that's the way ranked choice voting works. You will not have people that don't have less than 50% support winning the office any longer.
Do you know whether other states that have ranked choice voting have a statute similar to Nevada's, which authorizes or allows voters for no one?
I'm not aware, Justice Hardesty, whether it is or it isn't. But I would submit this, that such obscure, and I would submit it is obscure unique provision of Nevada law about this, none of the above. I think we would all acknowledge that. I believe it was even discussed at the Ninth Circuit, is my recollection, that it's obscure. Or believes that such an obscurity should deprive the voters of their right to be able to consider this an issue.
It certainly, it probably is obscure in the context of what other states do, but it is embedded in our law.
And so
when one assesses whether you determine ranked choice, it's a fundamental question. If the I vote for none of these is in the top five, does that go on or not? Is the top five limited to natural persons?
Sure.
I'm not trying to be argumentative, but it seems to me that that is an extremely critical question when talking about the description of effect. And again, I think generally the description of effect covers most of the points here, but this is pretty material, I think, in our state.
So, Justice Hardesty, I think the problem becomes that we're limited to 200 words. And every, by the way, I mean this absolutely respectfully. I know all seven of you, and I have great respect for you. I suspect if I put all seven of you in a separate room and asked you to draft a description, I'd get seven different descriptions.
I would defer to Pickering and Kadish for sure.
Well, that's, but my point is this. Anyone, and I take this very seriously. Anyone can use this description of effect process to knock out any initiative with which they disagree. Let's just face reality. That's what the description, that's what these kind of challenges are being brought by. So anyone can go into the initiative and use an obscure provision, whether it's state law, constitutional law, etc., to say, you know, that's really important to me, so therefore the description.
Mr. Bice, with all due respect, I think that's how both of us have made our living, is finding obscure legal issues.
Okay, you're probably right about that, and I see I'm way over my time, and I apologize, Mr. Chief Justice. I should have sought your grace before continuing on.
Thank you.
I thank the court for its time.
Your Honor, 2 minutes, correct?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice. Well, I think what we have certainly drawn out from this is the complexity of what we're facing. Some of the argument you just heard, I think, tends to make the point if there are multiple subjects.
But you didn't argue this.
What's that?
You didn't argue this.
I didn't argue that part. That's right. That's
okay.
True. It's still a fascinating question, and I'm happy to respond to it, but I don't need to. It is there anyway, right? But I think what we're saying is that 200 words becomes awful tight when your subject gets too big, when you're trying to stuff too much sausage into the casing. So what I want to do is just for a minute and a half, think about what it would have been like had they done it the way we're suggesting is proper and compliant. We're not trying to deprive anyone. We're just saying it should have been two initiatives. Imagine if you would have had two clean initiatives. Single subject for one would have been, we're going to change the primaries to do it this way. Other one would have been, we're going to change the tabulation and the casting of votes to do it this way. Maybe with those foci, you would have had better descriptions of effect. You could have talked about, you would have had 200 words to talk about whether you think this is going to devastate minor parties or be great for them. You could talk about the effect because it exists. Whether you think it's great that candidates can self-identify rather than be nominated by parties, or you think it's terrible. It's an effect, and it should be there. And if you had two initiatives, you could do it. With ranked choice voting, you'd have 200 words and maybe a little more focus on the questions that you all have had on that. It strikes me that these two are very clearly two separate initiatives. So I want to close on this. I understand it's June. I know they've spent a lot of money, and they've got a lot of signatures. Good for them. They made that wager. The state of Nevada and its democracy has maintained for 160 years without these. We do not need to push this through the meat grinder to get somewhere that doesn't, where we don't have to be. There are other elections, there are other ways to get there. This should be two very separate initiatives for all the reasons we have talked about today. And if there are no questions, Your Honor, I'll submit to
you. Colleagues, any questions? How, Mr. Schrager, would you square the position that you're putting forth today that these are two separate things and one could exist without the other with our decision in the education initiative pack on the taxes to fund public education, where we said, look, one's going to be a new tax, one is going to be an increase on an existing tax, so those could obviously both exist separate from the other, but they're both related to funding education, so they can coexist.
What the court was doing there, as I understand it, was recognizing that the requirements of Article 19, Section 6 meant that those two taxes had to be functionally related to serve the purpose. That it resolved that question. May not have been comfortable with it. But those two taxes, disparate as they were, and they could have existed on their own, that it was resolving a contradiction in its jurisprudence that says, okay, you want to raise this tax or have this expenditure, but you've got to have a tax in order for it to work. Otherwise, you're caught in a catch-22 as a proponent, and that would frustrate all manner of ballot initiatives. So the secondary tax in the education initiative case had to do with solving that particular question. That's what made it functionally related and germane and would quickly go unnoticed as to the interests involved to a sufficient level.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. The briefing was excellent. The argument's been great. Appreciate you being here. The matter will stand submitted. Stand at ease. You want to take a break?
Jesus.
Okay. We'll stand at ease and reconstitute.